I'm Roger Meacock. I work under the sort of name of Natural Healing Solutions. I qualified as a regular sort of normal vet, if you like, in the early 1990s, and actually worked in a farm-only practice for a while. And so I sort of had quite a good farming background.
Whereabouts?
I was in Buckinghamshire and then down in the New Forest. So I sort of had a good understanding of what was going on in farming, and even obviously that was in the early 1990s, was the peak of the BSE, and I could see even back then that I could see that the government wasn't really batting for the farming community and for farming and food security and all the rest of it even back then. That's why I moved down to the New Forest and sort of widened my remit. I went to a sort of farm and equine practice, although I still concentrated mostly on the farm side of things. And then, in trying to prove to myself that the alternative side didn't really work, I discovered that it worked better than I realised. And
Now, so what are the alternatives? It's an either or here. What are the two approaches?
well, the sort of the pharmaceutical sort of conventional approach to veterinary medicine and human medicine as well is very much symptomatic suppression. So you've got antibiotics, so you've got anti-inflammatories or antihistamines. So they're all trying to suppress the symptoms. Whereas the sort of more natural, holistic approach is to try and put the body into an environment where it can actually heal itself. So it's a very different sort of understanding and approach, really. And that was sort of quite a rude awakening for me and a very fast learning curve. And I was one of the first people in the UK to get involved with a technology called Skenal or Skenna, so depending on what some people call it. And I was the first vet in the world to use it on animals. So I
So
went
what's
sort of,
that?
it's a Russian device. It was developed for treating people. And Alexander Karasev, the guy who invented it or led the research team, he was obviously a very clever chap, did a joint degree in medicine and electronics. And back in the days of the USSR, before Perestroika came along and pharmaceuticals industry got its grip behind the Iron Curtain, as was, he realized that there weren't many resources for treatment in those days in the former USSR. So he realized that the body worked on electrical principles, and that if you could effectively set up a conversation with the body, you could potentially guide and lead it down a healing path. And so that's what he attempted to do and actually set out and did it. So he recognized that if you're going to speak to the body, you're going to have to speak the right language. So he actually built a component so that when the signal on an oscilloscope, if you look at it, it looks like a nerve impulse. And then he recognized that wherever you get any pathology, which could be a physical injury or it could be an organ malfunction or anything really, you get changes in the electrical properties of the skin. And so the skin becomes a window into the body and the interface as well. So once the device finds an area, usually a projection over the affected joint or organ or muscle or whatever, where the problem is, then it will read the electrical properties of the skin and recognize that there's a problem, and then it'll put a signal into the body to get the body to address it. And the body responds, but in doing that body response, it changes the parameters on the skin as well. So very quickly you get into a feedback loop whereby the skin and the is sort of the interface of the conversation, and the device and the body interact through that, and the skin effectively starts to lead its own healing treatment. And so that's why it's such an effective piece of kit, because it's not my idea as a vet or a human practitioner, because I work on people as well as a human practitioner. It's not my idea of what I should impose on the body. It's the body saying what it needs from the device. My job is simply to decide where to place it and what sequence of placements to do and the rest of it, and then the device and body work it out between themselves
So
thereafter.
how does this fit into wider alternative medicine, such as homeopathy?
I mean, it's all based on frequency. So there will be, although the nervous system obviously has its own sort of nerve control of the body, there are also frequencies. So the extracellular matrix in the body is a communication system in the body from the holistic understanding. I think even mainstream is starting to recognize what Alfred Pischinger discovered many years ago, that the extracellular matrix is a communication system within the body as well. So the vibrations and the electrical signals from the scanner will also be impacting and working through that as well. So, and then you've got acupuncture points have got a lower electrical resistance to the skin around them. So the signal will preferentially go through bioactive acupuncture points, those that are known and those that aren't so well known as well, according to what the electrical resistance in the meridian below is doing. So although we're sort of working on the skin and interfacing with the nerves, the way that that's occurring is also interfacing with the acupuncture system and also just frequency through the extracellular matrix as well. So there's it's sort of communicates with the body on multiple different levels.
Wow, interesting. So, but I mean, I know you're sensibly also very concerned about preventing illness in the first place and looking at
Yes.
various inputs in I mean, okay, so in the human side, but mainly the animal side that are causing trouble. So the industry is always trying to get the farming community hooked on some new cash cow or other, possibly for livestock or all sorts of things. But I mean, the introduction of different sorts of feed, this kind of thing, can affect health. I mean, we know, don't we, that through BSE, and it might be, maybe you can start with that, that it was actually the treatments that the government was prescribing for farmers that were causing the trouble. So maybe you could just take us through this idea of actually illness in animals being caused by the various forms of legislation and things that farmers are being told to do.
Yeah, no, that's very true. Farmers took the brunt of BSE, and they were blamed for being greedy farmers and all the rest of it. And actually, what happened, as you said, was there was changes in Brussels, really, and the EU and Europe wide about the rendering process for the feed. So it was really the feed manufacturers who were lobbying the political powers to get the rules changed so that it was either cheaper to produce or they could use different sources of protein to go into the feed. And so it was the change in that rendering system that supposedly allowed the prions to cross species and set up BSE. And I know that there's another theory to do with organophosphates, and I think there's some validity to both, to be honest. I think diseases are very rarely unifactorial. I think possibly the use of the organophosphates might have weakened the cow's resistance to the prions, and the they then took a hold, and as we know, we saw mad cow disease and saw the staggering cows on the telly and all the rest of it, and changes in behavior. So I think things work together, and that's also part of the problem with the reductionist attitude to science, where research is done but only changing one parameter at a time. And I can sort of understand there is a good reason for doing that on one level, but that's only really useful when you've got unilateral or a unipolar cause of a disease or a disorder or whatever else you want to call it. But when you've got multifactorial things going on, and EMFs is another classic one on that. It's if you're only going to change one parameter, then you're never going to get the right picture. And so very often on the holistic front, we're not just necessarily doing a treatment in isolation. We might be changing diet, or we might be, changing exercise regime, or looking at the other environmental factors like EMFs or whatever alongside. So a research situation isn't going to allow you to do that sort of approach within a trial. So it will look at one aspect of it and then conclude that it wasn't effective. And it will do that for each of the, for argument's sake, five or six different factors that you might want to change, and completely misses the fact that if you change all five or six together, you actually get the result that you want. And it isn't symptomatic suppression. It's actually enables the body to cure itself, because at the end of the day, all biological systems are self-healing mechanisms. It's just, we heal, we turn over cells every day. The body I have now is not, there isn't a single cell in my body that's the same now as it was 20 years ago. And so that turnover process is ongoing on a daily basis. And healing or disease is really the failure of that process to go to completion properly. And so if you can create the right environment of the body where that sort of turnover process can actually go back to blueprint, then there's no reason why things cannot heal.
Now, look, farmers are getting quite annoyed right across the world. I first came across this in the Netherlands, but it's spreading. It's going right across Europe. It's in France at the moment. There is unreported massive disruption going on by farmers, motorways being blocked, government offices being basically buried in manure, and generally peaceful, but actually sometimes a bit violent action by French farmers. The British farmers are this week threatening to get militant after their protest outside the budget was cancelled at the last minute by the Met Police for no good reason, after having rather tricked the farmers into negotiating over several weeks. Now, there's all this stuff in the background to farming, which is that net zero and the idea that that they are causing climate change by using fertilizer. And by growing livestock rather than plants, which are better apparently for the carbon content. But anyway, the farmers are getting pretty annoyed. I wonder if you could just take us through what you make of this, and obviously, particularly from a livestock point of view, what are the government really up to, and have the farmers got a case?
Oh, absolutely, the farmers have got a case. And it's not happening by accident. This idea that they've miscalculated, and the inheritance tax thing was just purely somebody in the civil service not doing their sums right is absolutely ridiculous. This has been part of the plans for a very long time, really, since the Club of Rome chose climate as the vehicle behind which to unite the people under an existential threat to accept the losses of freedoms and rights that they wouldn't otherwise accept. And so climate has been chosen deliberately as a political cosh, really, to use against groups. And obviously, we all know money talks, and if you follow the money, you usually get to the root of the
Yeah, but hang
problem.
on, because you don't need to be a genius to see the climate is changing. I mean, we're in a very, very mild December at the moment. I mean, every December recently has been like this, and the weather has changed. Is that you can't really argue with that. Over the last 50, 60 years I've been alive, I've seen it change enormously.
Yeah, I mean, weather does change. It's called weather. That's what weather does. What does, and we it goes through cycles. If you go back to the 1500s, 1600s, the Thames was frozen over. We're actually still coming out of that last mini ice age. But the idea that this is all man-made and it's down to farming and it's down to the cows is complete con. It's completely made up for political ends, and that's why climate originally, the sort of, if you remember back in the sort of 70s, 80s, we were actually heading for an ice age, and then it came climate warming, and then they realized actually it was going up and down, and it's called climate change now because they can't decide whether it's warming or cooling.
But it's very difficult to argue with the idea that we should be growing more trees, for example, isn't it? That's what the government's saying, more trees.
Well, that's fine, but then don't pull down the rainforests in Brazil and all the rest of it, and don't blame CO2, which actually increases the greening of the planet. There's been quite something like 25% increase in greening over the last, 20, 30 years or whatever it is. And because CO2 is the food of the plants and obviously the trees as well. And so more CO2 equals more plants equals more food. Not just for humans, but obviously for the animals as well that eat the plants. So, I don't, I, you know, every and everybody wants less pollution in the air, less particulate pollution, and all the rest of it. But demonizing carbon dioxide and methane, like they've done with the, again with the cows and the Bovaer to try and suppress the burping of the cows, is purely using climate as a means of attacking farming, because you've got people like Bill Gates who've invested heavily in buying up farmland because they want to grow plants and create their frankenfood that he's invested in. So, there are huge political agendas here, which with farming at the brunt of it, and also to a certain degree that they're trying to keep the population sort of less healthy, if you like, is probably the kindest way of putting it. Because if you we're not supposed to be plant eaters. We are hyper carnivore in terms of our evolution, and so we need, it was why the paupers in the old days ate the plants and the rich people ate the meat, and it became a crime to poach and all the rest of it, because they understood that meat was the most healthy nutrient dense form of food that you can have. And so they want to get people onto being plant-based, because then they'll be slightly fundamentally ill, which will then be good for the pharmaceutical industry as well, because they'll be able to treat them. And people who are ill are less likely to rebel against the loss of jobs, the social credit scoring, control from digital identity and central bank digital currencies, and all the rest of the things that we're being threatened with, which isn't conspiracy theory because it's in their own documents. And people like the head of the Bank for International Settlements have already said that they want to get rid of cash because they want every transaction to be followed, and they want to know what's going on with their money, and they want to be able to say, well, you can't buy this or you can't buy that because of your digital carbon footprint or whatever. So, we are sleepwalking into control and a dystopian authoritarian technocracy if we don't wake up and recognize it for what it is. And the farmers are the brunt of that, because food is central to the health and the control.
Yes, several people have pointed out that the livestock farmers are really the only people left in farming. Now, let's just consider that farming is one of the, well, it is probably the most important industry in the country. Even though farmers don't necessarily think of themselves as an industry, it is a kind of factory floor out there. The barns and the fields, the workshops, the tractors, and all the staff doing their work year after year. Obviously, originally it was mainly horses. And during the first, or mainly actually mainly the Second World War, the tractors were brought over from the United States to, so that farm workers could go and join the infantry and etc. So it's much more mechanized nowadays, and in fact to some extent the mechanization has gone so far where you're not buying a tractor, you're hiring a tractor, you're renting a tractor, and if you don't complete the payments, the tractor will switch itself off in the middle of a field somewhere, whilst you're in the middle of trying to plough it. And so that's obviously a problematic for the farmers. But this idea, Roger, that the actually the only people who are in farming who are not under the cosh of the big multinationals, feed multinationals, seed multinationals, grain multinationals, are the livestock farmers, and it seems they're coming for them now too.
Well, I think, they've got to, if they want to control food, they've got to control all aspects of it. So it's sort of, if you sort of follow their twisted logic, then that's exactly what it is. One of the only reasons we survived the Second World War is because we had food security, and we just don't have it now. And yet, if you look at the agenda, the United Nations sort of agendas and sustainable goals and all the rest of it, there was a document that was actually commissioned by the government from Cambridge and Oxford University, I think one other university as well, and they're actually saying that by 2050 there will be no shipping, no airlines, no flights. So we're not going to have shipping, we're not going to have air flights, we're not the farming is won't be able to use so much fuel, and we know that you wouldn't be able to take heavy batteries onto the fields and not get bogged down. And we know we haven't already got food security. So if we haven't got, if we're not producing enough food in the UK, and we're not actually going to allow shipping and transportation of food around the globe, then where the hell are we supposed to get the food from? Because other countries all around the world are being told they've got to have the same policies. So it's not that we won't have flights or we won't have shipping in isolation. It's like the world won't have shipping, the world won't have flights. Now they're talking about having lockdowns for climate so that things don't go up in the air and go on the seas and all the rest of it. So the logic behind it just is so flawed. It's absolutely ridiculous, but it's all in their documents. And you've got people who fly a desk who've never been on a farm in their life and have got no idea what nutrition is or what farming is, sort of drawing, pull it, pu pushing the buttons and holding the reins. And I don't know of any other industry other than farming where the original producer doesn't control the prices. So what we've got in farming, we've got the supermarkets tell the wholesalers what they're prepared to pay, and then the wholesalers say to the farmers, well, the supermarkets are only going to pay us this, so we've got to buy it from you from this, and so that's the price you're going to have to produce it for. And if you can't produce it for that price, then that's tough. So but there is no other industry I know of where the originator, the manufacturer, doesn't set the price, which is obviously determined by market forces in terms of fertilizer prices or fuel prices or whatever, or seed prices and whatever else. And also, as you said, the seed companies are trying to create the situations worldwide where heritage seeds are outlawed as well, so that farmers, in certainly not perhaps so much in the UK, but certainly in other countries like India, the third world countries, the farmers there aren't being allowed to hold on to their seeds for their following year's crops. And it becomes a crime to try and do so, or the seeds just won't be available to do it. They're not they haven't got the ability to be held to do that. So we're sort of manipulating the whole of nature and farming and food production purely for the sake of lining the pockets of the stock market, those who've got sufficient money already to invest it in BlackRock, who control all the different markets, and manipulate the companies to do whatever they gives them the highest profits.
Well, it certainly seems like the supermarkets are working as a cartel, and so they can fix. I remember chatting to one of the farmers at one of these demonstrations in central London, and he was saying, "Well, we are price takers, so that just means we're going to give you a price. It's take it or leave it." And often this is meaning that time limited commodities like milk are just simply being dumped in rivers and into the sewage system. Perfectly good stuff because the supermarket is refusing to take the milk at the price which will allow the farmer to actually make any money. So they're being forced in many ways to sell at a price which is actually a loss to them. So they're being driven into the ground and they're being painted as these kind of Tory, particularly by the left. But anyway, look, can you tell me a little bit about the sorts of measures which are being taken through food additives and this sort of thing, that farmers are being told you've got to have this, or maybe it's cheaper to have this, which is actually going to make the livestock ill.
Well, I mean, the one that's sort of topical or has been for the last year is Bovaer, which is a food additive. Well, it's classified as a food additive. It's actually a veterinary pharmaceutical legally, but it was classified as a food additive, and it changes the or inhibits an enzyme in the rumen, which is the main stomach of the cow, where all the fermentation takes place, and the microbes basically use all the grass that and the food that the cows eat to produce the chemicals that the cow then absorbs for its own energy. And so, by definition of changing the amount of methane which is being produced, so that the cows can't burp so much, then you're cha fundamentally changing the constitution and the makeup of the microbiome, which is absolutely controls the cow's physiology. So by definition, Bovaer is a pharmaceutical, but the manufacturer was allowed by the Food Standards Agency and the Veterinary Medicines Directorate to self-classify it as a food additive, probably because it's politically prudent. Because of climate, they didn't uphold the rules as they should do, and they've sort of authorized it based on a limited number of trials with a statistically insignificant number of cows in those trials, and obviously those trials were paid for and produced by the manufacturer, and they've concluded that Bovaer is safe. And the only data they've got to say that is because they believe, or they were led to believe by the manufacturer's data, that the 3-NOP, 3-nitro-oxypropanol, which is the main active ingredient, is rapidly metabolized in the cow and doesn't go into the milk. Whereas in actual fact, an independent study done in New Zealand showed that 17% of the NOP does go into the milk. And in Denmark, where Bovaer has been mandated by the Danish government, farmers are reporting significant side effects with cows. So they're getting food drop, so they're not eating so much, which obviously then is going to affect their milk production and their energy metabolism. They're getting sick, so they're getting diarrhea, they're getting fevers. They're getting, and in some instances, they're dying, and the calves are too, and some of the farmers' families who are working on the farm are also being adversely affected by this 3-NOP, which, in its sort of pure state, if you're handling it, you're supposed to wear full body protection. Well, I know it's, effectively diluted, if you like, in the feed, but if a cow's sticking its nose in the feed, even if it's a pelleted feed, there will still be dust there, and within that there will be the 3-NOP, and it's an ocular irritant and respiratory irritant. So last I looked at a cow, the nose was literally just above the mouth and the eyes were just above them. And so don't tell me when they stick their head in a trough that they're not going to get eye irritation and respiratory irritation as well. And obviously the farmers got to be working in that dusty environment, especially in a hot summer too. So they won't be wearing full PPE. So it's not really safe for the people who are handling it. It's not really safe for the cows. And there's actually been no study done to make sure that the health and welfare of the cows themselves have been properly assessed. Regardless of what the Food Standards Agency have been trying to tell me in their correspondence, the chief veterinary officer emailed me, and she agreed with me. I think she had actually, to be fair to her, she had already raised the point that there was no health and safety research done for Bovaer to see the effects on the cows themselves. And on that basis, it shouldn't have been authorized.
So this stuff is also appearing in supermarkets. Is it properly labelled, and what's its effect, and how do we identify it?
Well, We only really knew about it sort of December last year when Arla, which is one of the dairy sort of big dairy processors, they sort of tweeted on X or X'd on tweet on Twitter, whatever its way around it is. They posted on X to say that they'd started a trial. I think it was just with 30 farms, but even so, it was enough to get people concerned. There was no indication that the milk was not going in for into human consumption, and so there was a big boycott of Arla products, and they produce not only just milk, but they also sort of sub or have the contract for producing some other dairy products, and butters and whatever else. So, but also what we don't know is if that milk is then going to other food presses. Food processors. So, is it going into cakes and breads or all the rest of it? We don't know. I mean, obviously, for 30 farms, there would only be a limited amount of milk being produced, and I gather that that trial has now ended. But what I don't know is whether, although the trial has finished, whether the farmers are still being encouraged or told to carry on giving it, and how many other farms might be using it as
Well, look,
well.
this is a massive problem, isn't it? I mean, you can't organise a boycott if the stuff isn't actually being labelled on food products.
No, I agree. I think,
It's very much like the genetic modification, GM food, and also this whole process of irradiation of food.
I mean, food isn't healthy. I mean, we can, there's lots we can talk about on that as well. I mean, pasteurization for milk actually makes milk unhealthy. It was originally done to because there were bacteria and contamination in milk, but farmers have been forced to clear, not just recently, but for decades have been producing very high quality clean milk, and there's no need to pasteurize it, and yet it is pasteurized, and yet the pasteurization process kills off a lot of the enzymes and nutrients that actually make milk really
Is it
healthy.
still possible to get raw milk?
There are a few farmers who will still produce raw milk, but they've got to jump through more hoops to be able to sell it from their farm doorstep. But I would encourage people to do so and contact your local dairy farms and encourage them to produce raw milk, because it is actually ultimately the most healthy products that you can have in terms of milk. I'm lucky that I've got a dairy farmer not too far from me, where I get my raw milk from. So yeah, but it is, as you say, it's just another example of how the food is being made unhealthy and isn't being properly labelled. And I think possibly the way I think the Bovaer needs to be attacked is to find somebody who's got the legal know-how and wherewithal to come on board and actually do something about challenging the legal status of
Yeah, I mean, I
Bovaer
can
as a feed
remember.
additive.
Yeah, I can remember as a youngster seeing some of the first supermarkets really popping up. Price Rights was one of them, and I'm thinking, gosh, this is a big change, because up until then we had, we had your butchers, we had your fishmongers, we had your greengrocers, you had your grocers in individual shops. I mean, obviously there was a fair bit of tinned food around, but generally speaking, there was no such thing as processed food, packaged food, stuff that's ready to go into the oven. Nothing like that. I suppose
No.
a part of this is the increase in the working of women. I mean, because in the 1960s and 70s, most women were housewives. They didn't work. There was plenty of time to prepare food, fresh food from the original ingredients, and food processing wasn't really seen as even necessary. So there's so much to this. But anyway, Roger, I wonder if you can just sum up in a couple of minutes how people can find your work and follow what you're up to.
Well, my website for my work is naturalhealingsolutions.co.uk. And if people want to look at the correspondence that I've had on Bovaer with the Veterinary Medicines Directorate and the Food Standards Agency, it's all up there to look at. And likewise, my correspondence with the Veterinary Medicines Directorate, putting a warning shot across their bows against trying to stop them from licensing or authorizing any mRNA products for use in in animals in the UK, which so far so good, but certainly that's another area of concern that I have. So I'm sort of trying to keep tabs on what's going on at that level on those things. I've also written a paper about PCR tests, which I've had published in the Journal of Independent Medicine, which basically calls into question the use of PCR tests in a clinical environment. I'm trying to sort of line a few weapons up that farmers can use when they've got somebody knocking on their door.
Well, what about the bird flu? This is going on and on. We're also seeing slaughtering of cattle, this kind of thing. So this is a little bit worrying too, especially when you've got farmers lining up to try and stop the authorities coming to slaughter cattle.
Yeah, I mean, it's going on in France with lumpy skin disease, which again, I don't see the need for doing that, especially because lumpy skin disease is a viral disease, and it has to be passed by vector. So it has to be a mosquito bite or insect bite or tick bite or something to pass from one cow to another. So I really don't see the need if you've got one or two cows in a herd of 100 or 200 or whatever. I think in France they have much smaller herds than we tend to have over here. But I really don't see the need to have a cull policy when there's an intermediate vector required. If you've got it in an individual cow, then yeah, it's not pleasant, and what we see on the skin isn't just what's going on. There's sort of quite a lot of vascular damage going on deeper in the cows as well. So okay, you cull that cow, but there's no need to cull all the rest because there's
I mean, I'm
no
just
contagion.
frustrated. I'd like to hear more people like you up on the mainstream media discussing this and calling out the authorities. Anyway, Roger Meacock, thanks ever so much for joining us.
No, pleasure. Thanks for having me on.